This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In the news this week, the race for the U.S. Senate hits the warpath and turns ugly.
War hoops, the tomahawk chop, and charges of outright racism in the Brown-Warren Senate race.
And speaking of the rough and tumble of politics, Congressman John Tierney and Republican challenger Richard Tesei debate and make their case to represent the 6th Congressional District.
My opponent, Mr. Tesei, was the leader of the Senate Republicans. He voted with Republicans 100% of the time. It's comical to listen to you not make on that basis.
For Congressman Tierney to be calling me an extremist in any way is just laughable.
Also, remembering John Silber. He led Boston University for a quarter century and was known for his brilliant, strong opinion and those Silber shockers during a stormy run for governor.
I think of John Silber as the one that got away for Massachusetts, honestly. He would have made a great governor, despite the Silber shockers.
Also, continuing developments in the scandal at a Boston crime lab. This afternoon, state police arrested Annie Ducan, the former state chemist who allegedly compromised thousands of drug convictions. She's being charged with obstruction of justice and falsifying her academic record.
According to state police reports, Ducan admitted that she improperly handled evidence, forged colleague signatures, and violated drug testing protocols for 2 to 3 years while she worked at the lab.
Here's Attorney General Martha Coakley speaking just a few hours ago.
This is the beginning of the criminal investigation charging process. She's only facing 3 counts today relating to 2 particular cases. And so if you think in terms of the scope of time and the number of cases, we do expect this to be an ongoing investigation. This is not the end of the charging.
WBUR's David Boeri will be joining us later in the show from Boston Municipal Court with a little more on that program, on that story. But first, for some analysis on that story and the rest of the week's news, we're joined by two members of our Week in Review panel. Scott Lehigh, columnist for the Boston Globe. Scott, always great to have you. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Also with us, John Carroll, communications professor at Boston University and creator of the blogs CampaignOutsider.com and It's Good to Live in a TwoDailyTown.com. Welcome to you, John.
It's good to be here.
So, gentlemen, Annie Ducan is now in custody, charged with violating protocols at the state lab that have put thousands of drug convictions at risk. What's the next step in this investigation? It doesn't end here, does it, Scott?
I would think not. No, we're going to have to watch an awful lot of these cases be sorted out, go through a process, have a special court of sorts go through and look and decide is this one that we can retry or substantiate, or do we have to let this person walk? And I think we're going to feel the effects of this for some time to come with a lot of people who are of questionable savory status being let back on the streets.
Indeed. John, your take on this?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think the other thing that should be done is look into the supervisors. I mean, this was a case that moved so slowly, and even when they had evidence that something was wrong. So one of the interesting things about the startling things about the Globe piece today is that a supervisor didn't act even after learning that Ducan had forged other chemists' initials on some drug samples. Now, I don't know what the innocent explanation is for using somebody else's initials. You know, like mine were at the dry cleaner. I mean, you know, how does that work?
I forgot what my name was.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, I think that there's a lot of answering to do in terms of the structure and in terms of just the delay in acting
on
this. It took a long time.
Yeah, we learned from this police report that there were a lot of suspicions and concerns about her for a long time, and yet she remained on the job, right?
Yes. It seemed to me, reading between the lines of those stories, that she was a mentally unstable person, driven by to do a lot more than she possibly could by reasons that we don't quite understand. I expect we're probably going to see her vastly overcharged here. I mean, 20 years. I think the anger that people have at this is going to lead to charges that whose consequence outweigh the what someone who's of that status probably should really serve.
Well, and then that's going to be even heightened, when they find out how much money this is going to cost the state, because there are going to be after every drug defendant or convicted drug defendant gets out, they're going to have a lawyer coming and suing the state. So that's going to be a whole nother sort of subplot.
And we really don't know how many thousands of cases we're talking about, but they do threaten to overwhelm an already burdened criminal justice system. Now we're talking about these special courts to handle these cases. Is this the best way to at least as a first step, to begin to clear up this mess, Scott?
Well, I've never been an administrator clearing up one of these messes. I have to confess, I don't really know. You look at it and you say, I guess you need to focus just on it and you need to sort through it. And you know, the governor has moved reasonably expeditiously. You've got to address that. I mean, this is a classic one. If you do not have the evidence, you can't keep it, or if it's tainted evidence, you can't keep someone in jail just on a suspicion or something that might have been sort of dummied up in a lab. So a lot of them, you are going to have to make a judgment and let them go. I think John's exactly right that the procedures in the lab's ridiculous, that they didn't have some way of checking. But this is what you so often see in the private sector. You see a big problem that you never could have imagined would have gone, would have escaped notice or wouldn't have been acted on, that escapes notice until it's so obvious, and then there's a scandal, and then you put systems in place, and, you know, frankly, then they tend to be ignored the next time around.
Well, let's move on to politics, and with Election Day just over a month away, the race for the U.S. Senate in Massachusetts has turned nasty. As we heard at the top of this segment, at a Scott Brown rally last weekend in Boston, supporters of both Brown and Democrat Elizabeth Warren turned out, and we learned that some Brown staffers caught on tape were leading the crowd in Indian war whoops and the tomahawk chop, an obvious reference to Warren's claim of Indian ancestry. Senator Brown says he doesn't condone such attacks and tactics, and he warned his staff to cut it out, but no apology to Warren or to Native Americans. Scott, what's your take on this turn of events in the U.S. Senate race?
Well, I think that the whole fake Indian Native American thing and his add-on is a lie. He and his campaign obviously want to drive this issue. And they want to do it. They're trying to. I think it reeks of desperation, frankly. I think they see the momentum going her way in this race, and they're essentially rolling burning barrels out of the back of a pickup truck at her, hoping to take her out on a character issue. I think that he has a new add-on saying she got caught in a lie. I think the ad is really much closer to a lie than anything that Elizabeth
Warren. Well, let's listen to that.
Said.
We have a clip for it. Here's a clip from that new ad from Scott Brown.
Elizabeth Warren got caught.
You know, you need to come clean when you're caught.
It seems like this is a pattern for her.
I think it should affect a lot of voters and how they feel about Elizabeth Warren.
We already have enough people in Washington that will say anything. Don't need one more.
So what do you think, John? Scott suggests this sounds like desperation. What's your take on it?
These are some curiously articulate people. I think that, and coincidentally, using a lot of the same language. So I'm immediately suspicious of this spot. But I also think you see a pattern here. The first spot that Scott Brown did on this topic, he used news reports. The second one, he uses men and women on the street. I mean, he's trying to distance himself as much as he can from these attacks. I mean, he still has to get on and say, I approve this message. But he's got to be desperately regretting that he got involved with the People's Pledge, because this is Karl Rove's job. This is the job for super PACs to come in and do this kind of dirty work. And I think that the blowback on Scott Brown is something that that could be a serious effect of these ads. The other thing is he's got a perfectly good alternative to this in Elizabeth Warren's corporate clients. He's got an asbestos case. He's got coal miners' health care. He's got two issues that are really easy to attack on and really complicated to defend on. And that always favors the attacker. And for the life of me, I don't understand why he's not going all in on that front rather than this front.
Yeah. Well, in fact, he is demanding that Elizabeth Warren release a list of her corporate legal clients who she was working for while she was a Harvard professor. She hasn't done that yet. Is that fertile ground to go after Elizabeth Warren?
Well, that's a fair question to ask, certainly. I mean, a lot of this campaign riprap, we're in the silly season, and a lot of it is designed, you know, just to try to cast your opponent characterologically in the worst possible light. I was very surprised in their first debate, and have continued to be surprised, that he himself, I mean, his asset going into this race is that people think he's a nice guy. Mm-hmm. They think he's a really a pleasant guy. He's, you know, anyone can chat with him. And you really put that on the line when you yourself become your own attack dog in this thing. And that's what he did in the first debate, and that's what he does in these ads. And I think he's going to see a backlash. I mean, obviously, this is a strategy designed to generate resentment, particularly in white men, I think. And you know, a certain type, a certain constituency, something I think of a talk radio constituency. I got to say, I personally I've looked at a lot of numbers saying that people don't think this is really that big a deal. They are not willing to leap to the most negative conclusion about her because of it. And I think he risks a real backlash.
Can I just add one more thing this? I mean, I'm really surprised there hasn't been more attention to this clearly she's not aspect of this attack, as if being 1/32nd Cherokee is something that has to be visibly evident.
Yeah.
I think that he's sort of gotten a pass on that, and I think it's a ludicrous thing to say. And I don't understand why more attention isn't paid to that. It seems to me to be a sort of a farce on the he's trying to put over on the public.
And of course, that was the first line that he delivered in the debate. We've got another debate coming up Monday night, so it'll be interesting to watch where that goes. Well, funny how when there's a lot on the line, these races can turn nasty. And speaking of which, Democratic Congressman John Tierney is in a tough race with former Republican Senator Richard Tesei. Tierney has been dogged by questions about what he knew of his brother-in-law illegal offshore betting operation for 2 years now. One of the issues, should he have disclosed more than $200,000 that his wife received from one of her brothers? Here's what Tesei told us this week.
You know what? It doesn't matter if it's a gift or if it's income. Under the federal law, when you're a congressman, you're supposed to report all of the income coming into your household. I got to tell you, questions of character and integrity cut beyond partisan lines. And I think people are looking at this and saying, you know what, I think we can do a lot better.
And here's how Congressman John Tierney responded.
You know, Mr. Tesei has one angle here. He can't talk about his wreck at the State House because of 26 years of unremarkable service. And he can't talk about his allegiance with the Young Guns and Paul Ryan and those people because they want a radical agenda that clearly this district won't take. So he's trying to go after my integrity, which is intact after 20 plus years in business and 16 years in Congress and fighting for the middle class.
So a recent poll done by WBUR, commissioned by WBUR, shows Tierney holding on to a 7-point lead. It also showed more than 20% of voters have yet to make up their minds, so he could be vulnerable. What's your view on how this race is shaping up, John Carroll?
I think it's a nasty race, and money is going to be a big issue. They did not take a people's pledge up there.
That's right.
So there's plenty of third-party money coming in, and there's some real smash-mouth advertising going on up on the North Shore. I think that, in a way, Tesei has more weapons, more ammunition than Tierney does. I mean, if Tierney wants to go after Tesei, he has to go after him on sort of ideological grounds. Tesei can go after Tierney on ethical grounds. And I think a lot of times, if you're talking about a 30-second ad, you can make more hay out of ethical lapses than you can out of ideological ones.
Mm. Scott,
I don't see this ending well for Tierney. I think it's I think he's really got an albatross around his neck here, and his position essentially is I was Sergeant Schultz. You know, I didn't know anything about any of this, and. There's no proof he did, but it's a little hard to believe. I think Richard is right on the, as I understand it anyway, on the congressional reporting that he should have said that this money came in. On the other hand, I mean, Tierney will use he will be part of the right wing. He'll be part of Speaker Boehner's crowd if he's down there. And there is some potency to that argument. I think it's much more potent in the Senate race than it is in a House race. So, but I got to say, I think going into the last month or so, it's I would give an advantage to the Republican here.
I guess the big advantage that I would give Tierney is in Massachusetts with President Obama, who's still pretty popular on top of the ticket. It's an uphill climb for just about any Republican. But I think you're right. I mean, I think Tierney is, if there's a Democrat out there who's vulnerable, it's Tierney.
Yeah, one of the interesting things in that they had a debate this week, and neither one of them brought up sort of family matters. Tesei is vulnerable a little bit on some real estate mishigas that he was involved in with his parents. Tierney's vulnerable on the gambling issue, and neither one of them brought it up when they obviously could have. So I think they may be seeing a mutual assured destruction scenario here. And be thinking, you know, if we both leave this alone, it'll be a wash and probably work out better all around.
Finally, yesterday, we learned that John Silber died. Silber led Boston University for a quarter century. He helped transform it from an academic backwater into a hugely wealthy and academically significant institution. He was a champion of high academic standard, chairman of the State Board of Education, chief architect of the MCAS exams, which all Massachusetts public school students now take. He was was also known to not suffer fools gladly. He was controversial, pugnacious, not afraid to speak his mind and offend with his sharp opinions. Here he is talking to WCVB's Natalie Jacobson during his gubernatorial race in 1990.
What do you see as your strength, and if you will, if you think you have one, a weakness?
I think that my strength is competence, and my strength is honesty.
Okay, and your weakness?
And I think that, I'll let you find the weakness. I don't have to go around telling you what's wrong with me. The media have manufactured about 16,000 non-existing qualities that are offensive and attributed them all to me. Let them have their field day. You can pick any one of them.
So there's vintage John Silber. John Carroll, what are your recollections of John Silber?
Well, my recollection is don't attack Natalie Jacobson. that's a really bad campaign strategy to have. I knew John Silber glancingly, and I have to say that he was unfailingly gracious to me, even though I unfailingly drove him nuts when we would appear on shows like WCVB's 5 on 5, the old news and public affairs show. He was someone who I found easy enough to get along with, but then again, I wasn't at BU when he was president. I will say, as far as him being president, he had more impact than the average university president might normally.
I think that's absolutely true. What about you, Scott?
Well, he was a man who never learned how to bite his tongue, certainly. I dealt with him for many years, and I got to say, I think if you showed him that you weren't intimidated by him, that impressed him. And I think Jeff Jacoby said this in a column, in fact, this morning, and he would then treat you reasonably respectfully. He was a very significant public figure and public intellectual here, but he came with a lot. I mean, there's a lot of broken eggs with whatever John Silber did. So, on balance, I think his contribution was positive and important, but I think he could have accomplished the same thing with a lot more diplomacy.
Can I just also add, he had an uncanny ability to make Democrats vote for a Republican. and I think that's an unusual talent here in Massachusetts.
Well, we spoke yesterday to John Wessling, his successor as president at BU. And when you talk to people like that who really consider John Silber a giant intellect and a man with the courage who could really speak and follow through on the courage of his convictions, I mean, you do come away with a certain amount of respect. We also spoke to Marjorie Claproot. We heard that tape earlier in the show, who talked about John Silber as being the one that got away from Massachusetts, that he would have made a great governor, perhaps. But Scott, as you suggest, he certainly didn't have the ability to talk within the framework that politics demands.
He did not have political skills. I disagree. He would have been a great governor. I think it would have been a very acrimonious time, because you just don't get your way on everything as governor with other power centers. I got to say, I think John Silber was a very bright man. I don't buy the John Silber, this transcendent genius stuff. I think he was a guy who tended to take gut-level notions and kind of cloak them in intellectual garb, and he was good at it. But oftentimes, if you really looked at what he said, didn't make as, if you, not everything, but there were some things that you said, well, this is just John taking something that's a kind of a gut-level feel of his and pretending it's much more significant and well-grounded intellectually than it is. And I thought that was a weakness he had.
Well, let's move on to our hubbub, that story that didn't rise above the fold or maybe onto page one. Meghna, let me come to you and ask you for your hubbub.
So everyone here knows how our radio Boston staff are frequenters of the local Starbucks not far from WBUR. So my hubbub has to do with the fact that there's yet more evidence of, depending on your point of view, yuppification, gentrification, whateverification of South Boston, because apparently a planning approval has been given to a Starbucks in Southie. It's going to be on 11 West Broadway in South Boston. I really appreciated how Universal Hub noted that that means that there's a Starbucks in South Boston before even Jamaica Plain. So who would have thought it ever? But that's my slight hubbub about a continuing evolution or devolution, depending on your point of view, of South Boston.
These are indeed the end times.
End times. At least we can have our double tall lattes while we watch the end of time.
John, your hubbub.
My hubbub is the Wall Street Journal this week published the Announcer Bias Index, which measured how biased your baseball team announcer or announcer team was.
I don't think this is going to... I think I know where this is going.
No, this is going to really surprise you. First of all, let me just say, old friend Ken Hawk Harrelson,
sure,
who is a...
he's out of Chicago now, right?
He's out of Chicago for the yep. White Sox. He had 104 biased comments in one game. The first runner-up who would serve if he's not able, Ken is not able to serve out his term, was the team for the Indians that had 23. Ken Harrelson had more than the entire American League combined. Now, the Red Sox had zero. This may surprise you. Zero bias comments. And as one commenter to Campaign Outsider said, that's probably because they never talk about the game. They just talk about a whole bunch of other stuff. And, you know, they auction off their scorecard or they talk about paper airplanes. So that may have tilted the results.
That's great. Scott Lehigh, let me come to you for your hubbub.
Mine is local candidate Mitt Romney's continuing ambiguous relationship with Romney Care. He, this last week and a half or so on the campaign trail, he has cited it several times, noting that most recently asked about compassion. He talked about how, look, I got everyone covered in my state. This is an example of compassion. And then went on at his next campaign stop to call again, as he has all along, for the repeal of Obamacare, sort of proving that his compassion, I guess, ends at the Massachusetts state line.
Fascinating. So, gentlemen, thank you all. I have a hubbub. Sorry. A late-breaking hubbub. It's not a long one. We were talking about John Silber, and I made this point to you before the mics came on. I interviewed him a few times. I've interviewed a lot of people who think a lot of themselves and are smart and full of themselves. I think he was the one and only interview where I felt truly intimidated by him. So that's my final recollection of John Silber.
Still, that's saying a lot, Anthony, given that you're 9 feet tall and 450 pounds.
I know. It's impressive. Well, anyway. Scott Lehigh, columnist for the Boston Globe, thanks so much for coming in today. Have a great
thanks
weekend. And John Carroll, communications professor at BU, thank you. Have a great weekend.
Thanks.
Stick with us, because coming up after the break, we'll hear the voices of a generation stuck. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.
And now back to the news of the day, which is the arrest of Annie Duquesne. That's the state crime lab chemist who allegedly compromised thousands of drug convictions. She was charged today in Boston Municipal Court. WBUR's senior reporter David Boeri is there. David, what was Annie Duquesne charged with?
Maybe she was charged with two counts of obstruction of justice and one count of falsely pretending to hold a degree from a college or university.
And why did Attorney General Martha Coakley say that this arrest happened today?
So the warrants issued, the state police went to Ms. Duquesne's house this morning in Franklin. They brought her in, so she made her initial appearance here. She came in wearing a ponytail, straight face, did not look over toward where her husband or family were sitting. The not guilty plea was entered for her, and we actually had a reading, brief reading of the account, and I can tell you that the counts were applied. In 2010, Ms. Duquesne sent her resume into court. She appeared as an expert witness, and she told on direct and cross-examination, she stated that she had a master's degree in chemistry from the University of Massachusetts.
David, we've got just under a minute here to go. I mean, a lot of people are now wondering, where does this investigation go next? I mean, Attorney General Martha Coakley says they can't even speculate on a motive for Annie Duquesne, but you've been covering this story for some time. Just got a couple seconds, though, but what do you think the next step is?
Well, the next step is to go back and conduct more interviews. They're going to try, now that she has a lawyer, unlikely that she's going to be talking with them, but they have to go back and build the case against her. They are not yet ready to charge her in the full case for the criminality that they are going to allege was done in the laboratory. But meanwhile, she is on $10,000 bail, an electronic GPS monitoring device. She surrendered her passport. She cannot leave the state. She has the conditions that many people who are charged with minor drug charges face when they come into court and are arraigned here.
David Boeri is WBUR senior reporter reporting live today from Boston Municipal Court. David, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. There's more Radio Boston in just a moment. Stick with us.